And it will be, we're going to aim again for 15 minutes. Obviously, people always take a little bit more, but and then we'll come back to hear Kirsten Wells' talk and Mo Lee's commentary, and hopefully we'll have time for questions. So, Linda.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you very much for organizing this conference and for asking me to introduce the speakers for this panel. My name is Linda Haywood, and I'm a professor here at Boston University in African and African American Studies. Our panelists, I'm going to introduce them now, Professor Alex Gill. Hill is a digital scholarship coordinator for the humanities and history at Columbia University. That's my alma mater. An affiliate faculty of the Department of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia. He serves as a collaborator with faculty, students, and the library, leveraging non-trivial technologies in humanities research, pedagogy, and scholarly communications. Current projects include ED, a digital platform for minimal editions of literary texts, the Translation Toolkit, and In the Same Boats, a visualization of transatlantic intersections of Black intellectuals in the 20th century. He is founder and former chair of Global Outlook Digital Humanities Initiative, co-founder and co-director of the Group for Experimental Methods in the Humanities, and the studio at Butler, that's Butler Library, I think, at Columbia University, and founder and co-editor of SX Archipelagos. Professor Hill's presentation is entitled The Minimal Computing Gambit and Global South Archives. Our second speaker is Professor Beatrice Jaurabe. She holds a PhD in comparative literature from Stanford University. She is professor at the School of Communications of the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. She has been a visiting professor at Stanford University, Dartmouth College, New School for Social Research, Princeton University, New York University, and the University of Sergi-Pontoise. Her awards include a Guggenheim Fellowship 2004, the Andres Bello Chair at the King Juan Carlos of Spain Center at NYU 2012, and the CNPQ Scholarship for Research Projects. She has authored Fin de Seculo, 1998, Mapa do Maravilhoso do Rio de Janeiro, Choc do Real, 2007, Rio de Janeiro, Urban Life Through the Eyes of the City, 2014, among other books. Professor Jaurabe's research explores literary representations, media products, and architectural emblems as expressions of urban imaginaries and national inventions in Brazil and in Hispanic America. Her current research project discusses the dilemmas of nation building during the first decades of the 20th century, focusing on the specific case study of the Rondon Commission's exploration of the hinterland of Brazil. The title of her presentation is Mambiquaris in Paris, Archival Images, Appearances, and Disappearances. Our third speaker this afternoon is Professor Rudolf G. Wagner. He's a senior professor of Chinese studies at Heidelberg University in Germany, an associate at the Fairbanks Center, Harvard University. He's an intellectual historian with a strong interest in the political implications of philosophical and literary works, as well as the transcultural interaction between China and the world in in areas such as key concepts, political symbols, media, and institutions. He has initiated the Digital Archives of Chinese Studies, DSCHS, which now holds some 5 million documents in Chinese and other languages, including vast numbers of documents that have been taken down by Chinese authorities or by private loss of commitment to preserve them. He was one of the founding directors of the Cluster of Excellence, Asia and Europe in a Global Context, Shifting Asymmetries in Cultural Flows at Heidelberg University. He is the recipient of the highest German scholarly award, Leibniz Award. The title of his presentation, Future Memory, Preserving Diverse Voices from and About China from a Time of Unification of Thought. And our last speaker, who we should not consider the least, is Kirsten Weld. She is the John L. Loeb Associate Professor of the Social Sciences in the Department of History at Harvard University. She's a historian of political conflict and social movements in Latin America. Her first book, Paper Cadavers, The Archives of Dictatorship in Guatemala, 2014, offers a broad mediation on how history is produced as social knowledge, the labor behind transformative social change, and the stakes of the stories we tell about the past. Her study is a historical and ethnographic work of the archives generated by Guatemala's national police, which were used as tools of state repression during the country's civil war, kept hidden from the Truth Commission, charged with investigation, crimes against humanity at the war's end, stumbled upon and rescued by justice activists in 2005, and repurposed in the service of historical accounting and post-war reconstruction. Wonderful. Paper Cadavers won the 2015 Waller Duke Human Rights Book Award and the 2016 Best Book Prize from the Latin American Studies Association's recent History and Memory section. It will be published in Spanish by Avansco in 2017. She is currently writing a history of the Spanish Civil War's impact and legacies in Latin America, for which she was awarded an ACLS fellowship. The title of her presentation is Cold War Archives and Democratic Aspirations in Latin America. Thank you very much. These topics, they're all, I'm excited, I'm out of, so let me stop here and turn the podium over to our first speaker, Professor Keedle.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Good. Yesterday, during the question and answer session, one of the speakers suggested that I expand my point of view. So my thinking, I think it was to expand your thinking. So I am going to expand it a little bit for you today. And I'm going to do so by talking about all cultural artifacts in existence today in the planet. let me pull up this, hold on a second. I minimized this, no. There it is. That didn't work. All right. Before I begin proper, I wanted to reread a paragraph from my first keynote that delivered at the Digital Humanities Summer Institute several years ago. Feels like an eternity now. The title of that keynote was called The Library of Babylon, or the Digital Library of Babylon. And this is the opening gambit of that presentation. In a section called Exeunt to the World. I feel privileged to be here with you in this Congress. When I received the kind invitation to offer my remarks on the subject of a global digital humanities, I was elated and immediately remembered that other marvelous Congress, El Congreso de Jorge Luis Borges. In that other Congress, Alejandro Ferri remembers for us about 20 Argentinians who would gather on Saturdays at the house of another Alejandro, the red-bearded, wealthy landowner Alejandro Glencoe, inspired by guillotined Anarcasis Kutz, Citoyen de la Humanité. Glencoe had founded El Congreso del Mundo to represent all men of all nations, sick on the men. Their vast mission combined with their small numbers led them to come up with the very clever solutions. Glencoe, for example, could represent landowners as well as men with red beards or men sitting on a couch. Naturally, they needed a Library of Congress. They started small with a few encyclopedias. Soon enough, the classics followed, eventually inflamed by Pliny the Younger's suggestion that no book was without some merit, the Congress set about collecting all of them, including 3,400 copies of Don Quixote in different formats, theater bills, and yes, dissertations. On the day the bankrupted Glencoe ordered the books to be burned, he invited all to take a carriage ride through the night streets of Buenos Aires, declaring with great authority that the real Congress of the world was the world itself. All accepted and exited clear-headed onto the largest of tents. We're going to do an exercise. I'm going to show you a series of projects based on African-American history, and in particular, slavery. I'm gonna ask you to think which ones of these count as digital scholarship. We're gonna play the definitional game just so that I can move on to my main claim. I'll keep you hanging a little bit before we do this. Let's start here. This one is Wordseer, produced at Berkeley. It analyzes, using some NLP categories, slave narratives in order to find out what kinds of adjectives and nouns were used in the slave narratives related to other adjectives and nouns. Teaching us, for example, that the word amazing and awesome was used next to the word God very often. In these narratives. This is an article on gender construction and enslaved African women, published in JSTOR. This is the narrative of Frederick Douglass in Gutenberg. This is the Knotted Line, a project done on Scalar, redesigning Scalar in order to draw a creative, artistic timeline of United States control of bodies. I'm gonna pause it. The music, sorry, it's not working. It froze. Not a commentary on Scalar. This is Musical Passage, a project to digitally interpret one of the earliest surviving manuscripts of a slave song. This is the Transatlantic Slave Trade Voyages Database, about three decades in the making. It was even before digital. This was a project that was already imagined to be as a series, as it was already managed a series of volumes. This one is by UNCG's The Digital Library of, on American Slavery. And this is a library type produced archive. This is unknown no longer, produced by a historical society. This is the slavery database of one of these kind of touristic houses that imagined the nation as a series of pantheoned fathers. This is the American Slavery Correction by Redix. The last time I actually did this exercise, I pointed out that over here they had said slavery, a controversial subject in American history, and everybody started tweeting out and they fixed it that same day. This is a 3D reconstruction of the 1853 Richmond slave market. This is Gail Sengage, Slavery and Anti-Slavery. This is a Tumblr that collects everything coming up in digital scholarship, produced by Jessica Johnson, the PhD, AD PhD blog. And this is A Tale of Two Plantations, a reworking and reimagining of what a database could be for slavery plantations that does not assume that the hierarchical relationships of family trees is the way that one could understand slavery, and neither should we replicate it in databases. Now I want you to take 30 seconds to meditate on which ones of these are our current scholarly record. Which ones of these count as digital scholarship? I hope you said all, because to yourself, there have been many, I've done this exercise with a longer time where we do sheets and people sign, write what they think is and is not, and then we debate. At the end of the day, this is the body of knowledge, manifested in all its genres, that we are accumulating right now in the world, in the largest of tens, about slavery, about the fate of peoples from Africa in this country that still haunts us today, that is actually contorting this country so much that it might end up killing the whole planet. So this is not just a regular archive, this is an archive that is at the core of some of the major global problems right now. And here is the thrust of my talk. This archive and all its manifestations is being produced through very, very different labor arrangements and very, very different relationships of ownership and debt. For example, this one right here is a very, very large archive of documents. But it costs libraries money to license it. And unless you're affiliated to an institution, you won't have access to it. It was not produced by African American scholars. It was produced by a company. So was the Gail Sengage one. And they own it. In fact, having worked in a library for 5 years and looked at the numbers that we're not supposed to share in public because of non-exclusionary, non-disclosure agreements that we signed with vendors, and understanding the bulk of our collection, I can tell you that most of the scholarly record produced in the past 20 to 25 years is owned by large monopolies. Now, then that may be fine if we consider that the work of scholarship needs a service industry to provide those skills that we don't take time to learn ourselves. Somebody, after all, has to have a job to bind books too and deliver them by donkey. There's two problems with that. One, we built our universities to produce a particular kind of product for the past 200 years. Some, you can argue, even earlier, down back to the 18th century Republic of Letters in Europe. And I'm looking forward to hearing about some of those formations in China. I know that in other parts of the world, these kinds of formations all lead to one thing, which is the production of monographs and journals in order to that drive their libraries, their teaching, the promotion, etc. Now, that's the first problem. The first problem is that the new world that we're dealing with, it is not geared towards that. Our university is not prepared to receive these new modes of production of a different kind of product. Again, also the reason why these monopolies can step in and take over your labor and repackage it, regurgitate it for a guaranteed market within the university itself. And when I say guaranteed, I mean this is being done by software now. There is software that purchases automatically large, vast collections of our own labor. The second problem. Is that these companies are not too big to fail. When Trump won, some of these companies, and they have names, Gale, Taylor & Francis, ProQuest, Elsevier, we know their names. We can look at their earnings. Some of them that are publicly traded took a hit when Trump won. It was a moment at which maybe the public thought, oh, this new regime is not going to support education. Let's get our money out. They bounced back. And that's because they have a fantastic business model where they're raking in 30% and 40% with free labor and guaranteed markets. It is one of the best rackets in the whole planet right now. And I come from a business family. I'm not a commie. I just don't like a scam. Most business people will tell you that a business that earns 10% profit is a good business and you want to invest in it. This one is earning 30 to 40%. So business people know that such a business cannot go down that easy. All right. That's not the right mouse. This also has a lot to do with debates about decoloniality and power and the fate of global politics. And the idea now is that I want us to start thinking about how to understand the global knowledge production at the scale of the planet. In a hybrid world, both analog and digital, where almost everything is born digital by now, since most monographs that end up being pulped begin as a Microsoft Word file. So I think digital humanities folks are very well positioned to start imagining how to actually map out the whole production of knowledge and flow around the world. And I think that's one of the things that makes us one of the most promising sectors of the modern academy. Our ability to not only map at a distance and read at a distance, but our ability to actually construct systems of knowledge production that are alternative and independent from those service industries, that actually create kind of spaces of prototyping within existing university structures in order to suggest a better world, or one that at least does not depend on monopolies. And thirdly, because this group actually does believe in memory work, in the work of the arts. They are one of the most staunchest defenders of the humanities. So because of those three things, we are well positioned. So the question then remains, what kind of models are we going to use to start understanding global knowledge production? A lot of the exercises we have done at the Group for Experimental Methods in the Humanities at Columbia actually ask themselves that question. One of our perhaps most recognized projects is the Open Syllabus Project, where we harvested about 1.2 million syllabi in the English language around the world, open on the internet, in order to understand what is being taught in the classroom. This is the top 10 list of texts being taught in the classroom in the English-speaking world out of the syllabi that were offered. I always thought it was cute that the elements of style is. But this, another derivative of this data, is actually my favorite. This is the galaxy of knowledge being taught in the English department, where every dot is, the size of the dot, every dot is a text, and the size of the dot is how many times it's being taught. And the dots next to any given dot is a text that is taught with it a lot. So if I go to Plato's Republic, I learn that Sartre's existentialism is being taught a lot next to Plato and a lot next to Darwin. I also know from looking at this list that though most universities have gotten rid of the core is still being taught de facto by most universities. And the canon is here with us. We never won the canon war. The memory of the world is still the memory of the great white man of the past. So we think together about how to understand this knowledge flows. This is the map of the IP addresses that are approaching Sci-Hub for articles. This is the flow of knowledge captured in a snapshot of the movement of us asking for essays and asking for ebooks. And it has a shape. Shapes start taking place. Theoretically, how are we going to understand these shapes and tie them back to all the ethnography, all the history, all the work of social sciences, all the work being done in English departments and French departments about understanding our documents, our past? How do we tie back these kind of very abstract, high-level models to that? I have a caricature version of this. Of what's going on in the world today, that it is super caricaturesque. But here it goes, because I think it is at least thought-provoking. Most of these monopolies operate in the North Atlantic world, Western Europe, North America, Canada, and the United States. They're based there, their profits stay there. They are producing the bulk of documents in the scholarly record right now. If you move a little bit clockwise, you go to Eastern Europe, where our brave pirates are actually freeing everything that these companies hold hostage and repackaging it for the rest of the world with better interfaces and with very reduced staff. In fact, we have met with many of them, and they work in teams of three or four and run the largest libraries in the planet. That is not an argument for starting to fire librarians. I work in the library. Don't fire me. You go down to the a little bit south. I'm going to skip China. There is a China scholar here, so I'm not going to get into that. Down in India, libraries are closing because some of these pirate libraries are actually making knowledge so accessible that librarians have been deemed unnecessary in some localities. At the same, yes, 2 minutes. Yeah, I'm almost done. If you keep going down clockwise down to Africa, you will notice that a large digital production is taking place right now through citizen scholarship, but that the institutions themselves have actually have reduced their scholarly production because of partnerships that are with the North, especially with these monopolies that are charitable. Finishing the loop is Latin America that has been the leader of open access because most of its institutions are actually tied to the state and are supported by the state, by taxpayer money. That's a caricature of the world, but it gets us thinking about how we are going about organizing our division of labor in this brave new world. And I'll stop there. I won't have time. I'm speaking a lot slower than I usually do. Long week. But during the question and answer session, if any of you are interested, we can talk a little bit about some of the technologies that we've been developing at the lab that actually take into consideration these labor arrangements at a planetary scale, and perhaps I can convince you to join us in this brave new discipline that will understand all texts, all images, all cultural production in the world. Thank you.
I'm delighted to be here. I'd like to thank Susan for the wonderful invitation, and also Tamsin and her staff for having put together this fantastic conference. Before I begin, I would like to situate. It is Nambi Juarez in Paris?
This one?
No, yeah, the first one. Okay, from the beginning. Okay, good. Can you hear me? Yeah, better? Okay. I would like just to position myself to tell you where I'm coming from so this can be understood a little bit better, and soon I will get to explain the title, which is somewhat enigmatic, no? I come from a very large public university, the largest public university in Brazil. This public university has recently been quite democratized. It is entirely free, so you can do all of your undergraduate studies, all of your graduate studies without paying any money whatsoever. And this means that we reach out to a great number of people, but unhappily, our libraries are beyond pitiful. So beyond pitiful. And I'm just saying this in order to make it clear that obviously we have to preserve physical materials, but there is an aspect of the widespread gain and access to knowledge that these digital processes in countries that are not as rich and not as favored as the US with their resources, it becomes very crucial. Having said that, on the other hand, there are many things, I'm sure Kristen will have a word on that, that are very worrisome, because with this mania for digitalization, a lot of public archives are literally crumbling. As you know, or probably don't know, Brazil is undergoing a massive economic crisis. Libraries are radically underfunded. Everything is falling apart. And so basically, digitalization becomes an excuse to digitalize these very crucial documents, especially about the military dictatorship, and then to say, well, it's been digitalized, we don't need to hold on to the original documents. And that poses, obviously, all kinds of questions about who has access to this information, surveillance, and so forth. So that's just to begin. How do I move this? I'm a teacher at a school of communications, and I can barely ask it the thing. How do I make the... Oh, Morris, can you raise up your hand when I've 2 minutes so I don't go talking over and over and over? Okay, thank you. Can you hear me? Okay, so what I'm going to say here is really a case study about a set of photographs, and I will get into it later. But I put in these three wide questions because throughout this conference, these kept repeating and unfolding in my mind. And one is the idea of technology and the preservation of memory history, the politics of access, and particularly in my talk, what I want to talk about is the role of photographer. We've talked a lot about texts, we've talked about words, but photography has not been so mentioned, and I want to link that with the idea of a kind of a haunting of the past that comes through these analogical photographs. The second big idea is the notion of digital worlds and the kind of dematerialization of experience. There was a paper in the first day that talked about communities, imagined communities, and I keep thinking that sometimes these communities become these sites for many kinds of empowerment, but also for strategies of nostalgia, because in the real world, people are much more dispersed, and they're building kind of virtual kinship communities that are not actually being experienced on a daily basis. And the last thing is about cognitive shifts. Also in the first panel, I remember Professor Hicks, I think he was saying, that people don't have time to read, they can't read, etc. There are all these pressures of making ends meet. But I wonder if that is really the case in the sense that people are Twittering, they are glued to their machines all the time. And I think one of the challenges that we're facing now is that people have an incredibly hard time being present in the present. They're never there. They're always there and somewhere else. They're looking at their computers. They're floating off. When you teach a class, it drives me insane, no, to get the attention of your students, really. So there's a kind of a loss of a three-dimensional relationship and a kind of a discognitive experience. So I think that is a very important thing in all of these processes that we're seeing. And the third thing is, what is the principle that is organizing these archives? And in this little story that I'm going to tell you, these photographs, they began under a positivist model, then they were incorporated into a kind of modernist structuralist model, and then now they're at a crossroads between a community and identity politics model. They're the same photographs, but they're being read in very different registers. Okay, these are the photographs that I'm going to tell you the little story about. These are photographs that I found in the National Library of France when I was doing research for an entirely different thing. And I found these microfilm in this really outdated machine. There were these 120 photographs of the Hondon Commission that had been donated to the Société de Géographie in 1925, and then all of a sudden they appeared in front of my screen. Very briefly, the Hondon Commission was a commission to explore the hinterlands of Brazil. This is, sorry for the poor quality of the map, but the library was closed. I will get to the end of that. It was, there was no access to library or the physical book, so I had to rely on these internet images. So the Hondon Commission goes into the interior of Brazil in a vast hinterland of states that are now Mato Grosso, Mato Grosso do Sul, Bolivia. And the mission was to connect all of these states through the telegraph line. Theodore Roosevelt, the American president, also went in one of these expeditions, not to string telegraph lines, but to make explorations in the interior of Brazil. He suffered mightily in one of these explorations, almost died, in fact, and in the end wrote this book, Into the Brazilian Wilderness, and you can see several specimens of his travels in the Natural History Museum. The point here is that this whole effort at communications was to string together the nation through these telegraph poles. By the time he finished this enterprise in 1915-17, this technology had become dated, so this enormous effort was almost, you know, not useless, but it had become dated. But what happened during this very arduous trek across hinterland Brazil is that the Hondon Commission, led by this positivist military officer, encountered a number of Indian nations and tribes. And so the three main objects here were communication, pacification, and exploration of this terrain, right? So here's Hondon, here's the microfilms. So here's this photograph that was taken in glass plate. I'm seeing it on the microfilm screen and I'm photographing it with a cell phone. And here is the Hondon himself in one of his first expeditions. Hondon was himself a Brazilian of Indian descent and a fervent positivist believer. And this has very important implications to his project and to the photographic process that he will undertake. So these images, you know, very eerily, in this very outmoded kind of a machine cropped up. And I was sitting in this very ornate room in the National Library of France, in the Richelieu room, in the cartography room, filled with golden mirrors and globes and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, these images of the Mato Grosso Indians leapt up on, they didn't leap up because this is an old, you know, outdated micro film machine, but it gave me a kind of a jolting effect. Not a jolting effect of surprise, but a kind of an idea of the uncanny and the sense of the return of the familiar in the unfamiliar space. And I kept asking these images, what are you doing here? What are you doing here in the National Library of France? What is going on? Why are you here? No? Why are these images here? There is a very famous book by W.J. Mitchell, and he has the title of the book is What Do Pictures Want, right? And what he is trying to suggest is that pictures are not just pictures, they also have a life, a material and symbolic life, and they come back to interrogate us about certain unanswered questions. And definitely this produced this feeling of unease in me, and I wondered why these pictures and what is the context and who remembers these. These are pictures that have not been digitalized. They were entirely forgotten in these archives. They were given to the Société de Géographie. The Société de Géographie was a very famous, prestigious geographical institution, and it had pictures of the great explorers of the 19th century and the early 20th century, and these pictures actually failed. They failed photographically. They were not published. They elicited very little interest. And the questions are, why were these pictures, they were given anonymously, and why did these pictures not resonate, right? And one of the questions that I think that I would answer this is that they lacked a kind of engaging ethnographic display. Now, we're thinking of Paris in the 1920s. We're thinking of a Paris that is still filled with colonial exhibits. The museum at the Trocadero, where Paul Rivet is the director of the museum. This is the famous museum where Picasso goes and looks at the African masks and has this epiphany and does all kinds of appropriations of so-called African, quote-unquote, primitive art, no? And this is also a Paris still not in the 20s, but until recently had human zoos. The Indians of Tierra del Fuego were exhibited in such of human zoos. And so why did these Indians from Mato Grosso, you know, from the hinterlands of Brazil, why were they not deemed that interesting? There is the 1928 pre-Columbian exhibit that was curated by Alfred Metreau and Georges-Henri Rivière, and that created a huge sensation, no? But the image of these Indians from Mato Grosso out there in that scrub, they were not Amazonian Indians. It was not like this lush Amazonian forest. It was this very harsh kind of scenario. This did not seem to fit in. And also what fitted in was the idea of Hondon as this great explorer, but his explorations were really a national project. And I think this is one of the answers. This is a moment when you have a whole imperial French project in the making, and for the first time, you really don't have a colonial power going into the interior of Brazil. What you have is actually the Brazilian army under the motto of order and progress, venturing into the hinterlands of Brazil. Now, a word about Rondon's Indianist policy before I talk too much and don't have time to say anything more, is that he was relatively innovative for his time. He had a motto, which is to die if necessary, to kill never, compared to the extermination of the Indians in Argentina under General Roca. This was, you know, a fairly humanitarian approach. But this did not mean that the Brazilian Indians were not equated on a very low evolutionary scale. So what he is doing is that he is venturing there, intending to use the Indian workforce to do the acculturation process, and at the same time, he is asking these photographers under very adverse circumstances, I mean, this was very arduous, these tracks across Mato Grosso, to film and take pictures of what he supposed, like Curtis, like the great American photographer Curtis, who took the pictures, saying, okay, I'm taking the pictures of these people that no longer will be here as Indians in this way. They will no longer survive in this way, right? I will go briefly because Indianism was at the height of fashion in this pre-Columbian exhibit and in the avant-garde kind of narratives, but Indianism in Brazil had been preceded by a kind of a romantic imaginary that fabricated this idea of the founding nation through the Indian and the Portuguese motif. And of course, this was a fabrication because the Indian motif was much less important at that moment than the gigantic presence of an enormous African diaspora. But since it was very hard for you to invent a foundational origin for a nation that had become recently independent with a vast population of enslaved people, the Indian motif comes up mythically in order to surpass that. In the 1920s, a group of Brazilian artists are in Paris, and they're keyed into the avant-garde experiments of Picasso, obviously, of Francis Picabia, of all of this, and they come up with the idea of refashioning the Indian motif as a cannibal motif, right? So here, this is the traditional kind of 19th century erotic romantic imaginary of the Indian, of the vanquished Indian. And here is the 1920s answer to this invention, which is called the Cannibal Manifesto, which declares that we are cultural cannibals, and this is a strategy of appropriation that we have to take into account. So it goes back to the pictures of Théodore de Brie from the 16th century, where he depicted all these cannibal feasts, and it deliberately incorporates that element in order to posit this as a strategy of cultural subversion, right? Now, nothing could be further, of course, from the idea of Rondon and his positivist mission than this carnivalesque cannibal kind of strategy. But the point to be made is that these people are together generationally. They are together in Paris. There are a number of positive officers in Paris in the 1920s, a number of Brazilian modernist artists in the 1920s in Paris too. And the Indian motif serves both ways, both as an idea of conquering and expansion of the Brazilian governance, and also as a mythological kind of overturning of Western paradigms. These are the first photographs of Indians taken by a Brazilian, by Marc Ferrez, in the studio fashion, in the enclosed studio. And here you see the Indians of Mato Grosso, these two small boys, Bororo. But here are the photographs of the Rondon Commission. These photographs have been digitalized in very poor quality. And so as I will explain later on, you only have access to them through digital means because the museum has been closed, and I will explain why the museum has been closed. So these photographs were produced in an album of the 1920s in order to celebrate the feats of the Hondon Commission. These are portraits, but at the same time, they're not really portraits. The Indians are being photographed under positive eyes. So what that means is that they're classifications, they're empirical data, they're typologies, they're not individual, but at the same time, what does it mean when you say individual, since this sense of subject and individuality is not a subject and individuality that is shared by the Indian tribes that are being photographed, right? But also, the idea here is that these people who are here included in this national album, they are on their way to disappearing. And that's why in the very first images, when I saw them in microfilm in the library, it was this jolting effect, because this is actually the beginning of a certain kind of end that had been photographed then. Because this is the beginning, the telegraph line becomes the way in which exploration will be. Okay, so I have to rush. These are the photographs of Hondon, and repeating this kind of saga with the gift bearing that is so iconic in the conquest of America. No, here again, although he is of Indian descent himself. And here are the acculturated Indians that are part of this becoming Brazilian civic mission, like this after and before. And these are the Nambiquaras. The reason I'm calling this the Nambiquaras is that Nambiquaras are going to be a very crucial, iconic nation of Indians for Hondon, because they were very fierce and resisted encroachment, and they're going to be an iconic nation of Indians for Lévi-Strauss, when Lévi-Strauss photographs them. Here's Lévi-Strauss photographs of the Nambiquara, and Lévi-Strauss follows the trail of the Hondon Commission. When he goes to Mato Grosso to do his ethnography, he follows that trail. Lévi-Strauss never comments on the photographs of the Nambiquara. In fact, he didn't publish these photographs in the first editions of Tristopique, only later. This is the Museum of the Indians. So we moved from a positivist model, the kind of avant-garde appropriations of the Indian motif. And finally, in the 50s, we have the consolidation of a museum made similar to the Musée de l'Homme in Paris under the influence of Paul Rivet. So this museum falls into total disarray and total decay. And it is occupied by homeless Indians who then occupy the premises, right? And protest against the demolition of the physical building itself. And then there's a huge hullabaloo about, are they really Indians? Are they not really Indians? How come they're Indians? And who is an Indian? Who is not an Indian? Because all of a sudden, in the Brazilian census, that until recently you had a fairly small Indian population, the amount of people who now declare themselves Indians has risen exponentially. So there are all kinds of debates about who is Indian, who is not Indian, who is entitled, who is not entitled. And this becomes an urban movement towards the preservation of community, which was something that we heard in the first panels, right? And here, significantly, this Indian museum falling apart and occupied by homeless Indians is next to the stadium of the Maracanã. If you remember, the Olympic event in Rio happened in 2016. The Maracanã Stadium underwent massive renewal. Tons of money was poured into that. And the crumbling Indian Museum was right in the way of the mega event of the Maracanã Stadium. So it was a very inconvenient kind of situation, right, for the branding city of the mega event. And this is the Museum of the Indian that actually exists, which I did not have access to, which is in Botafogo, and whose archives are digitalized, and the images that you saw came out of those digitalized archives. And the reason I didn't have access to that was because this museum was also occupied by the displaced Indians from the former museum. And after a cultural event in the museum, a scuffle occurred between security forces, employees, and the museum authorities, and eventually great damage was done to the building and the building was shut down. So just to end, I would like to just read briefly. So while the reports presented by Hondo, his speeches and writings are imbued with ideals of positive humanitarianism, the pictures taken by the Hondo Commission have had a life of their own. From glass plates to film to microfilm and now digital photographs, the Nambiquaras that look at us from computer screens can become disembodied images without context or content in the free-floating arena of the virtual world. I mean, they can be decontextualized. But they can also be summoned to testify and rekindle aspirations. From the heady atmosphere of Paris in the 1920s, with its assortment of colonial exhibits, ethnographic displays, and avant-garde appropriations of primitive art, to contemporary Rio, tensioned by economic crisis, social conflicts, and turbulent politics, these images evoke a past of scars, legacies, and aspirations. Pried from the dormancy of forgotten archives, they become spectral digital pictures that haunt the present and posit unanswered questions. Thank you. Thank you for your patience.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, let me thank the Society of the Humanities at Boston University for the kind invitation. And I'm very happy to be here, and I have already learned a lot. And before actually engaging fully into the discussion about the digital archive of Chinese studies, let me perhaps bring up a point which might be interesting for the broader discussion. There is something like a dark horse in the room, which is an unnamed gentleman, which happens to be the state. So we have been talking about the problem of technical archiving, namely question of different generations of archival records, which are difficult to transfer, and we have in our wonderful Heidelberg center of the internet technology, we have something like, well, perhaps 5,000 digital tapes and soft floppies and so on and so forth, which are illegible today. So this is obviously something that is real. The second is that we have a discussion about the question of business monopolies, namely business enterprises monopolizing research basically substantially funded by the state or foundations or the universities themselves, and that becomes then property of the digital providers like Elsevier and others, and that becomes then an exclusionary thing where you have what theoretically could be a flat earth of accessibility to digital resources ends up to reproduce hierarchies which are all too well known. But the third candidate in here, as a matter of fact, is the state. Now, a discussion in the United States might be forgiven of not mentioning the state as being essentially irrelevant, and very little of the discussion here has been addressed to it, but I'm not so quite sure whether that is, as a matter of fact, even true for the United States, but I will not deal with that. I mean, you saw the recent discussions in the federal government here about funding of the National Education of Humanities and so on and so forth, which obviously have a substantial impact on the question of archival presentation. And Professor Henderson this morning was mentioning that is there a master plan, as a matter of fact, for maintaining all these trillions of different formats and forums and archives and so on and so forth, which would guarantee that they survive over the next, I mean, even 10 or 20 years, you know? And obviously there isn't, you know, and that somehow looks as if there is another dark horse marching to the room, namely that that might be something like the state could be basically responsible for, to say, okay, this is a kind of a Library of Congress type of national responsibility to make sure that that is maintained. But the state comes in just not just as the kind of possible conserver of memory or something like that, but it is starts off, as a matter of fact, especially the nation state, its more recent incorporation since the early 19th century, as the administrator of memory. Namely, the state, nation state, basically takes on the responsibility that this memory and this history is ours, and therefore what's in, what's out, is what we determine. And that is a rather rigid form, which might, as a matter of fact, take on, you know, something like rather brutal forms, let's say the traditional Chinese state in imperial times, you know, a new dynasty came in, they would set down historians to write the history of the previous dynasty and then destroy the archive. That's just how you do it, you know. And that means that basically the administration of memory means that you don't only fill the books and the memory with the orthodox, one and only true history of what happened, you know, but you eliminate the options of thinking the alternative, you know, down to, you know, hiding it in some kind of little private writing or sort of accidentally preserved little tidbit of a diary or something like that. So the streamlining of memory comes in two parts. It comes, number one, in a censorship part, namely deleting those elements or letting them rot, you know, which don't fit the narrative. And number two, filling the airwaves or bookshelves or whatever you have, school records, you know, with what you want the authority, the one and only true history to be. And we have the linkage between that and technology, as a matter of fact, it's not as loose as you may think. Now, you all are familiar with one of the main archival sources for things which are not the great and famous and printed and officially preserved authors, but the common folk or people who might not have made it into that rank because they were dissident or something like that. There is one of the big historical archives is, of course, the police archives. And now we have the wonderful best link for that, of course, in East Germany, where you had, you know, something like, well, 11% of the adult population being informal cooperators with the state security. And the state security was part, of course, of the technological development in East Germany, which in the Eastern Bloc was certainly in many areas most advanced, so they built their own computers. So the East German computers, you know, have then fallen by the roadside in 89 with the unification of Germany, with the effect that, as a matter of fact, functional East German computers of this brand used by the state security were at that moment at the total number of 5. The computers have a short lifespan, you know, so they start falling apart. And the problem is that the digital records we have always been talking about there being print records and digital records, you know, and the question of preserving the book records and so on and so forth. That's very nice. But you have now moved into a situation where a very large amount of records are digital originally. You might print them out, perhaps, you know, so the physical form, you know, is secondary to the digital form, you know. So now the East German secret police archives are all digital. Now the problem without these damn computers, you know, you cannot access them. And that means that, you know, I mean, there is a range of, you're talking 10% of the adult population being somehow in there, quite a part of all those who are on the record as being observed, you know, even that includes a lot of Westerners like myself, right? So you have a very pleasant record there. And now they are moving over into sort of taking one of the survivors as the spare part, organ donor in a way for the other survivor to keep this damn single computer running. Now at the problem they're down at 1 because they are not produced anymore, and nobody has the money to produce them. So that one computer runs out of spare parts from the others, you know, you will have one of the largest archives of the actual social history of East Germany, you know, disappearing from the surface of the earth. You know, here you have, you know, very nice kind of a state technology and memory interface there. Now, in Chinese studies, we are talking, of course, about both of a history and a modern history of a unification of memory. Now, unification of memory is not a timeless enterprise, namely that memory, the one and only orthodox history, is always one of the particular given moment. That's a shared element in all socialist societies. You would have the same in the Soviet Union. I mean, you take, as an example, the Bolshaya Encyclopedia, you know, from 36, you know, the big Soviet encyclopedia, you know, well, you know, and then comes the big show trials, you know, and Trotsky is out, you know, and well, you know, then, and, you know, Borodin is out and so on and so forth. And then the subscribers to that encyclopedia get, as a matter of fact, because they couldn't reprint the entire thing, it was too expensive, so the subscribers get slips sent, you know, which they are supposed to glue with totally different entries, but on a similar alphabetical listing, to glue over the original one to somehow keep that in a helpless way up to date, you know. So that's part of memory administration, you know. And you have in the PRC, you get a constant habit in a way of standardizing history. The party makes decisions on history. So it's not just something where some historian says this or the other. No. The party makes some question on the history of our party, which always is also the history of the of China. And these decisions by the party leadership then filter down to the last TV broadcast, school book, museum, you name it. You know, so this is a way of homogenizing things. And everybody of you who has taught students coming from the PRC will know that the kind of a historical bios, you know, the basic grit of their setup in their heads is very successfully informed by this endlessly reflected and reproduced kind of official history which they have grown up with, and somehow alert them even to the fact that there is a lot of sort of odd ends in there which don't fit, is a very cumbersome and difficult process. And sometimes if that process is successful, they end up in no man's land because they just don't really know what to do now, you know, because somehow, if that is not what it is, you know, what is then what, you know, and then suddenly they got all confused and can't write their PhDs or whatever it is, you know, and sort of doodle around, a very complicated affair. So we have in the Chinese context there, an effort to, as a matter of fact, homogenize memory to a rather strong extent. And you might remember that we had just 2 weeks ago, this very sort of nice controversy with Cambridge University Press, when the Chinese propaganda department alerted them that on their website they offered, you know, a number of journal subjects, China Quarterly and a lot of books, you know, which are related to China in one way or the other. And the Chinese propaganda department, this is on the website which you can subscribe to. And there are some Chinese universities, a few of them only, which have subscribed to Cambridge University Press online offering. Right? Now, that's, you know, this is a place where Google is blocked, you know, where most of the other archival sources are not accessible. So suddenly you get through Cambridge University Press website, you know, if you are at Nanjing University or at Fudan University in Shanghai, you suddenly get access to a type of information which is not fitting the master narrative. And that's not good. So then the propaganda department writes the kind note to Cambridge University Press and says, would you please delete the following 1,300 articles and books, you know, from your online offering? And Cambridge University said, well, big market, we do it. And then you have a big sort of a hullabaloo among the scholars who protest when they hear about it. And Cambridge University Press then kindly reversed itself. But now, of course, they don't know what to do, in fact, you know, because somehow the next thing, we don't know how the Chinese propaganda department is going to react to that. But the likelihood is that they're going to say, well, tough luck, you know, your possibility of selling your online access in China is herewith cancelled. We haven't heard that yet, you know, but I mean, you get this kind of a little notice every day, and the specific form that takes is that the propaganda department is sending down something like, well, you know, every day to various internet providers and so on, sending something like 20 to 30 notices a day, what they are supposed to delete, what they are supposed to play low, no headlines with it, what they are supposed to stick only with the official narrative from the Xinhua News Agency and so on and forth. So you have a kind of a micro guidance, and that also is not just a negative one, it comes with a positive one. Namely, they have a wonderful army of the five centers, they are called, you know, namely people who get per web page note which is agreeing with the government line, they get a minimal payment there, you know, and these are something like the level of perhaps 2 million people, you know, who will then, you know, some public discussion comes up, you know, and then you have, you know, a lot of people who earn their little penny, you know, by touting, you know, or, you know, with their own words, you know, not just verbatim quoting something, that this is, you know, unpatriotic and unacceptable and so on and so forth. So you have a complex situation there. So we had I give you a simple example of how this we somehow operate on that. So the example is that there is in the Nanfang Zhoumo, that's the Nanfang Renwu, that's a kind of little journal coming up in Canton, a part of a big newspaper system, which is the Southern Weekend and the Southern Daily. So this is Southern Personalities. And Southern Personalities published something in 2004, an article on 100 public intellectuals in China, Chinese public intellectuals. Now, I saw that on the internet, as a matter of fact, that somebody alerted me to it, you know, and I said, oh, that's going to be a problem. Because evidently public intellectuals are different from the party. They might be party members, but they are not, they don't have their status as public intellectuals because they are speaking for the party. They are speaking for themselves. So my suspicion was, you know, we're going to have a big problem there. So I asked two of our student helpers to sit down and, but literally within minutes, you know, and download everything written by and about these 100 public intellectuals they could lay their hands on. Now, which was ended up being a huge a trove of files, you know, something they downloaded, something like nearly 2,000 articles by these people, you know, and then another 2,000, 3,000 about them, and so on and so forth, the discussion about them. So, and well, in this case, I must proudly say, you know, my understanding of the dynamics of the political process in China turned out to be 100% accurate. You know, the propaganda department was slower than we were. So something like 10 days after the article was out, you know, the propaganda department, number one, this periodical is being withdrawn from circulation. Number two, the names of these 100 personalities are deleted from the Chinese internet, which has a nice sort of a firewall around itself, and all their writings are taken down from the Chinese internet, right? So that's just, so suddenly, you know, we were the depository of China's, one small fragment of China's memory, you know? So that, as a matter of fact, is the idea which we have been operating with. Now, this library in Heidelberg, which has done this work, was when I came there in 87, was what at that time, I must confess in with apologies to the people who had built it up, you know, in my negotiations with the president of the university, I told him what he has there is something like a sausage parlor of a library, you know, and that didn't go down well with my predecessor and people who had been working a lot, you know, but it was a library in Chinese studies terms, which was, I mean, worse, well, it could not really be worse, but something on a level with the library, sorry for being impolite, the Chinese studies holdings at Boston University, which has, as a matter of fact, the big Asian studies department, you know, and an inexisting Asian studies original language library, you know, which is really amazing. You know, it's a big, famous university. And you know, you look there, you know, and says, you know, the Mugar does not have Chinese language books. They don't even have somebody who can read the title of a Chinese language book. Anyway, so now, so that was, of course, in a way, a clean slate. You know, we had just our 20,000 little books there. That's very nice. And we had a little bit of money, and eventually we got some foundation money, and I got some big prize from some $2 million, you know, let's put that in there. So that was all very pleasant. Anyway, we just started building that up and decided, okay, why don't we build it up, you know, without respect for the standard education of the librarians. Now, I apologize for the librarians who are here and who have much competence and much work on that, but there are certain rules among librarians' education which, as a matter of fact, I think are not really contributive. If you want to develop an actual hybrid library, you have to disregard them. Now, what are these rules? First rule is, a library is librum liber, is a book, you know, so a library does not collect films or musical scores or photographs. That's not what a library do. Other people do that. And if they don't, that's their problem. You know, now the musical library says, of course, we don't read Chinese, we don't collect Chinese music. The film library says we don't collect no Chinese, we don't do Chinese films. So this is a no-brainer, you know. But so that's the first thing. The second thing is that they basically assume that there are types of books which an academic library does not collect. The standard types are two, namely school books. And the number two is books which are, distributed at church doors or temple, which doesn't cost anything. Books which you cannot buy at a bookseller, you know, you don't buy those, you know. Now, if you just close your eyes and think about anybody who has a library with the school books of any country of the last 150 years, that would, of course, allow you to reproduce in rather great accuracy, you know, the type of nation-state education, you know, and the kind of values and so on and so forth, you know. Well, you know, you look around, you know, Harvard University has basically no school books, you know, the Widener Library and probably Boston University doesn't have it either, you know, because it's just not done, you know. And the same is true if you look at these church pamphlets or similar things like that, you know. They, of course, are a record of value and value changed to a substantial degree. And so you go to local temples here and there and pick up these things, you know, and suddenly you see, woof, you know, I'm able to talk about things which on regular things you can't please.
Oh, 2 minutes.
Oh, okay, yes. So, well, let's go into spend the last 2 minutes on the digital archive there. So what we basically have been doing is to harvest those elements which we considered have been unstable in terms of preservation of relevant memory. That means there is also a selection in there. Now, that does not only include people who make the public intellectuals I've been mentioning, but that includes also important internal documents which are not publicly accessible and might be disappearing. That includes records of party leaders which have not been published in China but have been published outside. That includes blogs. That includes blogs by dissidents inside and outside of China. Blogs by disgraced party leaders, you know, and so on and so forth. So we have basically put together, you know, a very vast amount that's now together something like 5.5 million files, you know. This type of record, which in terms of search, we still have a large problem, because what we would need is a multilingual search that is able, with a single search question, try to go through different language types of records, you know, Chinese, Japanese, English, German, French, you name it, you know. And that, as a matter of fact, machinery is not yet available. So at the present moment, we only operate with the rather clumsy keywords from the Library of Congress system, which for this type of Chinese problem are, I mean, inadequate to a level which is very high level. So it doesn't do very much, so you have to constantly supplement into subheadings there, something like that. And have, in order to prevent the problem getting into a legal system, because we have the lawyers, of course, breathing down our neck, like you all have, we have put all that by necessity behind a kind of a fair use wall, which is a password wall. Namely, people who want to use it and access it have to apply for a password and shortly mention what they are doing that for, and that sign that they will not use it for commercial purposes, and then they get access to this entire pile. And this includes now basically records which only exist as online documents. It includes records which do exist as printed records, but which are inaccessible in large parts of the world or anywhere else. You know, there are lots of things which I have managed to buy here and there, which nobody else has. So we have digitized them, put them in there. That includes journals, books, and so on and so forth. Right? It includes a huge set of something like 3,000 Chinese films. With the literature around it, it includes a huge amount of newspapers, you know, which we have digitized ourselves or bought digitized for, and it includes a huge music library, right? So we have, as a matter of fact, something like 4,000 records. That is both the notes, the tonal recordings, you know, and whatever reviews and so on have with it, you know. So this is a kind of a hybrid library, you know, where you can move, as a matter of fact, from the notion of a political scientist who never reads a novel, you know, but as a matter of fact, in China, novels are a key point of discussing a politics, you know, to a literature person who has no idea about the Politburo, you know, to somebody who is dealing with the economy and has no idea about movies, you know, so you can basically force people, you know, to jump out of their kind of nation state and field limits there, you know, and as a matter of fact, integrate these different things. They are doing that sometimes, but it's a very tedious process, and it might, as we all know from the structure of scientific revolutions, take a generational death, you know, to move to the next generation, which will for whom this practice will become completely normal. But at the present moment, I must say, this has been all done with minimal financing, so we are not very proud on that point. But let me finish with one sentence. One thing has happened is that our original idea was to create a flat earth for the lots of small pizza parlor library, Chinese studies libraries in Germany. Namely, that you would, even in a miserable library, would be able to do high quality research by having access to a wide variety of high quality sources. Now the problem is, with all the money we had, which was relatively speaking a lot, you know, in German terms, you know, in American terms, nothing, but we could not manage that. We could not buy national licenses, you know, for big databases. You know, there was no way to do that. But happily enough, you know, and somehow I was somehow in a way involved in that. Doesn't really matter. The Berlin State Library, you know, which was one of these old flagships, you know, way behind times, you know, doing buying books and doing this all very orthodox things. They hired somebody who, as a matter of fact, the world is moving on, you know. And this fellow has single-handedly built what is now by far the best digital library, you know, in Chinese studies and Indian studies and Korean studies and Japanese studies anywhere in the world. I mean, I sit at Harvard over here on the other side of the river. What do I use? I don't use the Harvard access there. I use the Berlin access because the quality is much better. You know, it's very simple. You know, it's broader. It's better, and it's a national license. Namely, from every stupid little pizza parlor in Germany, you can get in there for free, you know, and get access to the stuff. So that was one part. It's not the digital access part, which is more a hunting library. This is more the officially buyable, purchasable things there. But, you know, it was a very helpful thing, and I hope it will contribute to the improvement of scholarship worldwide. And now I have a lot of friends from all over the world who ask me, could we be friends? Do you become associate at your institute so we can get some kind of access to there? So I'm feeling very proud of that. Thank you very much for that.
So now we'll take a 15-minute break and reconvene to hear Kirsten Weld. Thanks. Yeah.
Here, take another one.
She had an emergency with her sister and child.